Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. One of the largest annual gatherings of U.S. amateur radio operators takes place this weekend, and La Crosse area ham radio enthusiasts will be among them. The American Radio Relay League, or ARRL, sponsors the two-day event that brings roughly 35,000 operators together, mostly by way of radio waves, from locations all across North America. Field Day has several goals rolled into the weekend. It's a social opportunity for ham radio operators to work together. It's a great way for the public to learn about and even use amateur radio. And it's a way for local clubs to demonstrate the often under-recognized services they provide to their communities. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Gatto picks up the story from here.
To the average listener, the dits and dahs and bleeps heard on shortwave radios or scanners are not very discernible, even obnoxious at times. Voice broadcasts are better, but even those can be challenging. And many of them can be attributed to amateur radio. Not because these broadcasters don't know what they're doing, rather it's because they do know what they're doing, which can include pushing technology to new heights. Over the past 100 years, radio hobbyists have taken what was wired telegraphy in the late 1800s and developed it into short and long-range wireless communications, a technology that most of us take for granted today in the wireless digital world we live in. The number of licensed amateur radio operators worldwide continues to grow, quickly approaching 1 million in the U.S. alone. Commonly referred to as hams, the interests of these radio operators have expanded into television, digital data and voice communications, educational programs for schools, and community service. This weekend's ARRL Field Day is the single most popular on-the-air event held annually in the U.S. and Canada. While those with a competitive spirit treat it as a contest, others use the occasion to practice their emergency response capabilities, to learn to operate radio gear in less than optimal conditions, and in some cases to demonstrate how they can help with parades, bike-a-thons, and other local events. According to the ARRL, ham operators range in age from youngsters to grandparents, including rocket scientists and rock stars, but most are your average down-the-block friends and neighbors, and I'll admit to being one of them, as are my guests today, including a couple representatives from one of Western Wisconsin's local radio clubs. Greg Miller is president of the Riverland Amateur Radio Club, and Dan Epps is chairing the club's Field Day events this weekend. Also with us is Todd Shea, the warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in La Crosse. He coordinates the local Skywarn program, which utilizes local radio amateurs as spotters during severe weather events. He's also an amateur operator in his own right. So welcome, all of you. Let's start with the basics. Greg, tell us a little bit about just what amateur radio is all about, a little bit of its history, why it exists.
Well, amateur radio is, it's kind of an individual event. I mean, people like to play with radios going back to when they were a little kid. You know, they throw a wire up in a tree. They make contact with a friend down the block or somebody across town. That's kind of developed into experimentation by these individuals. They build these radios and put up these antennas, and it's an excitement. So, yeah, that still goes on today as it did back then.
Well, and 100 years ago, there weren't any options. You had to build your own equipment. That's not the same today, though, is it?
No, you can buy your own equipment, but you can also still make your own equipment if you want. Yeah, although crude by today's standards, but you can still do that.
Today's amateur operators, or ham operators, and I guess we'll use them interchangeably, the handle of ham operators, some conjecture taking it back to the days of telegraphy, differentiating between a professional code sender and somebody who was kind of playing with it on the radio. But I'm not sure.
You know, that's been talked about quite a bit. In fact, I've even seen that in different ham radio magazines as to where that name came about. I'm not sure if anybody really knows, and there are several different ideas as to where it came from.
Dan, tell me a little bit about, from your perspective, too.
There are a number of different modes, you know, like Morse code, or they call it CW. And phone, of course, is talking with your voice. But there's a lot of digital modes now, too. Some of the older ones were like radio teletype, but now they're I don't know, there's dozens of different modes where you connect a computer to your radio and you communicate with other stations using some sort of digital modes to send and things like that. Mm-hmm. But also people bounce signals off the moon and or use satellites to talk with people or the International Space Station. So it's pretty interesting. I guess one of the things I've always liked about it was that, you know, you can give a call and someone will come back to you from some other country or you'll hear somebody calling and you'll be able to tell from their call sign that they're from Australia or something. And it's just a thrill to be able to try to call them back and have them hear you on the other side of the world. And
so for the uninitiated, people who don't understand what this amateur radio is all about, I mean, kind of physically what it is or how it works, many people are familiar with CB radio, I suspect. Mm-hmm. How does that compare?
Well, it's very much like CB radio in the fact that, you know, you have a radio and some feed line and an outdoor antenna.
And a microphone.
And a microphone and all of that. The difference with being a ham is that your license allows you to operate on many different bands rather than just one. So, you know, when conditions aren't good on one band, typically they're good on a different band.
So. Okay, we got to stop now. We're talking about bands and conditions. Greg, can you say a little bit more about what we're talking about here?
The different bands. When you're talking the different frequencies, like we might be able to operate within the 7 megahertz band, a certain segment. They're just named a little bit different.
Like regular radio, television?
Yeah, I mean, think maybe a good way to explain it is like FM radio is the FM band going from 88 megahertz up to
108 is where FM is.
Yeah, 108. Mm-hmm. That's one band, that's FM band. And AM radio, you know, is below that. It's like 570 kilohertz, which mm-hmm. is be like 0.57 megahertz.
What I hear you saying is that we're looking
at two different bands.
We're looking at a full spectrum. We're looking at AM radio as being very low frequency, FM radio being up there higher frequency, and then there's these ham radio bands that are kind of sandwiched in between and beyond. And some of those we're talking about are in what we might conventionally think of as shortwave radio.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, a good way to describe it, ham radio is you're talking to shortwave radio, and a lot of people listen to the shortwave radios. The difference is within our radios is the transmitter. So we're able to transmit a signal out on the same frequency that you would be listening to. And just to kind of clarify the difference between amateur radio and CB radios, mm-hmm. CB radios it's not required to have a license, and it's not as heavily regulated as amateur radio is. But we are a licensed organization, licensed through the FCC as individuals.
Mm-hmm. And what does that require?
That requires taking a test for each of the technician license, general or extra.
And what's on the test? What things are we studying for?
You're studying. One, the FCC rules and regulations. They're pretty heavy mm-hmm. in that, of course. Mm-hmm. And radio theory, electronics. So there's quite a bit that you have to study. And then you're thrown this 50-question test, which could be anything that you studied within that book.
Greg Miller is president of the Riverland Amateur Radio Club, and fellow club member Dan Epps is here as well. We're talking a little bit about amateur radio in conjunction with this weekend's field day operations, where you too can take in some of what this is all about. And we'll get on to that in just a moment. I just wanted to follow up, Greg, on one of the things that you commented regarding the tests. And do you have to be a physics major in order to really understand all of this, to be able to get involved? I mean, I thought this was kind of a family-friendly thing, this amateur radio bit.
No, really. All you really have to do is have that desire. You want to get that ham license. That'll push you to study.
So, and the electronics and what have you that you need to learn along the way, you just do.
For some people, I suppose that can be a little tough. It was a little tough for me to begin with, even coming from a home where my dad was an electrician his whole life. But that entry level, the technician, that one is fairly easy to get into. And while you're in that technician, you'll learn more as you go on.
So, Dan, if we went to your house right now and sat down in yours or a typical amateur radio ham shack, what would we see?
I don't know if I'm a good one to answer that question because I've been licensed, well, about 20 years, but in that time they've come out with radios that will do just about anything you want to do in one radio. So I only have one main radio plus another mobile radio so that I can, you know, listen to do things at once. And then, of course, I have a power supply and an antenna tuner. So a few things like that. But most hams have much more equipment. Looks like a wall of things.
Lots of radio equipment.
So,
Greg, what do you have?
Well, I have a wall.
You have a wall's worth.
Yeah, mine's a combination of my collection over the years as well as my father's who's passed away.
Oh.
So I have four complete stations set up and a lot of collectibles over the years. So, yeah, if you walk in my shack, it probably looks overwhelming.
And do you use all of that equipment?
There's only one set of radios I don't, simply because I really don't know how to hook it all up right now. But at the other three stations, yes, I turn them on, and there's one main radio I use in the shack. Another one is out in my camper. Of course, I use that when I camp.
Okay, so you've made reference to a camper, and Dan, you mentioned a mobile unit. So these, obviously, this is radio equipment that you can take on the go.
Yes.
Right. I guess the mobile unit would be the type of radio that you would have, you know, in your car or truck so that you can talk to people, you know, going down the road. Or if you live in an area that doesn't allow antennas, some of the, you know, newer communities have covenants that don't allow them, you can still have something that you put up on your car or put up temporarily and still be able to get on the air.
Let's talk about Field Day then specifically. That's going on this weekend. It's a two-day event. Amateur radio operators around the country, and in fact, I suspect maybe in other parts of the world will get involved in this as well. But Dan, you're chairing the event for the Riverland Club. Amateur operators get together locally. You go someplace out of the norm and set up equipment in a remote area and broadcast from there?
Well, like you mentioned, the object of it is to actually go out in a field somewhere.
Literally.
Or at least someplace where they're less than optimal conditions and learn to operate in those conditions, or part of it too is just to, you know, make sure the equipment that you have still works and that you can set it up in case it's needed in emergency or whatever. And the other part of it too is just to, you know, acquaint the general public with amateur radio. So we'll be setting up Saturday morning, and we'll be operating Saturdays starting at 1 p.m. through the day and night around the clock until 1 p.m. Sunday. The object is to try to contact as many people as you can around the country. And, well, we always contact some, too, outside the country in Canada and Mexico and South America and sometimes overseas as well. And, of course, you get extra points for running off of emergency power, either batteries or generators or solar panels.
Had me wondering, if you're out in the middle of a field someplace, what do you do?
Right.
So that's all part of it.
So you get more points, too, for making all your contacts off of some sort of emergency power. And they'd like you to set up in a public location to encourage the general public to come and see what you're doing and talk.
Are there, in fact, then opportunities with this setting for the public to talk on a radio?
Yes, that's a very good point, because as long as someone is there who has a license, they can let someone else use the radio and talk and make contacts with people. So
wherever they might be.
Right. So,
Greg, you're hosting this out at your place. Tell us, well, certainly we want to know where this is so that we can stop in if we'd like to this weekend. But what's unique about where you are out in the field, as it were?
Yeah, I'm north of Holman.
Okay.
5 miles north of home on Highway 53, just past what's Whispering Pines Campground. You turn left right after that campground. It's A. Johnson Road. It kind of S-curves down in there. Of course, right up on the road, we'll have a big sign that, you know, a special event station taking place, and another one at the entrance to my driveway. There'll be some campers back there, and feel free to just drive back and walk back and stop anybody and say, hey, you know, what's going on? We'll
so
be there.
So you're setting up tents and what have you for all of the equipment?
We have an emergency trailer that will have probably a couple radios operating out of that.
So it's like one of these communications trailers that we might see in news coverage from emergency places, that type of thing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you know, the reason we do that, imagine like the tornadoes and whatnot that hit down in, I believe it was Joplin, Missouri. I mean, that wiped out a large area. Communications were down. And we have to exhibit that we are capable of going into these areas, setting up a portable station, and giving emergency communications to whoever might need it, the police, fire, whoever. And we have exhibited that in all these disasters over the years. And part of it is because this one weekend a year that we practice this.
Well, let's use that as a jumping off point, and let's bring Todd Shea into the conversation, who's been patiently sitting by here and taking this in. Todd, in your role with the National Weather Service, you count on these guys, specifically with the Skywarn program. Tell us about all of that.
Yeah, we do. You know, as they were describing the hobby and the activity, I was thinking to myself that the reason I always had interest in it is because you can just be do it as a hobby and have the interest of talking to people around the world and that sort of aspect. But it also has this you can help your community aspect. Not only with special events going on, but things like what we use it for at the National Weather Service, which is help us with storm spotting, storm spotter reports, and overall communication. And, you know, storm spotters and storm spotting report is key in making our warnings more accurate, along with our radar information. And the amateur radio component of that storm spotter group is huge compared to just like with all our volunteer firemen and stuff. So we heavily rely on folks like Dan and Greg and other amateur radio operators, not only in the La Crosse area but around the region, mm-hmm. to pass along important, timely severe weather reports so that we can use them in the warning process. So
that's a basis to a lot of the information that you're getting is coming from the field, if you will.
It is, yeah.
From these
guys. And that's
the,
you know, they talked about how Field Day is kind of demonstrates that. But in some ways, we use that every time during severe weather season, and any time there's some severe weather in the area, we're talking to people kind of out in the field, because one of the other nice components of amateur radio is the mobility of it.
Sure.
And being able to talk to people that are visually looking at the storm, and they're giving us descriptions of what they're seeing. We look at what we see on radar, and we can put out a warning with a lot more confidence because mm-hmm. we're getting that real-time information. So we really appreciate and I said heavily rely on the assistance of amateur radio operators.
Now, just because you're an amateur radio operator doesn't necessarily make you a good weather observer. I mean, you may not know anything about meteorology and still be a radio amateur. So you must add something to this mix with training and programs like that related to Skywarn.
We do. We try to, you know, connect with the different clubs in the area, and we also hold storm spotter training, not just for the amateur radio community, but for all our potential storm spotters. But then we rely on leaders in the amateur radio clubs and groups also as kind of liaisons, and the emergency coordinators in each county too that kind of keep everyone on the same page. And we discuss how we want to work storm spotting mm-hmm. into the activities and such. So there's a lot of different groups that try to come together to make each severe weather season as safe as we can.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Todd Shea is the warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service here in La Crosse. Also in the studio with us today is the president of the Riverland Amateur Radio Club, Greg Miller, and another member of the club, Dan Epps, who's also chairing this weekend's field day activities for the Riverland Amateur Radio Club. Todd, you're working with more than just the local lacrosse clubs, because the National Weather Service has a large region that you're responsible for. How do you coordinate local Skywarn and amateur radio operators with those that are in, I don't know, Rochester or Lansing, Iowa, or wherever they might be. There must be some radio communications coordination that has to go on with all of that.
Yeah, yeah. There's about 13 different clubs that just my office works with, and that's just, you know, a small nucleus, of course, nationally. But, you know, we coordinate, especially in the spring with the spotter training season. We I myself try to keep in touch with a lot of the groups. We have meetings or our own local hosted seminars every couple years. And then we also have a event that we run in early December that started way back in the Y2K era, if that brings back memories. But where each year we have kind of a – it's a little bit like Field Day, but we have a special event in early December where we invite amateur radio operators from all around the region to just come visit our station for the day. And we make you know, contacts on high frequency radios, but it's more of a chance everyone kind of get together and allow us to show our appreciation for sure. Their efforts and stuff. So,
and that communications is on a long distance basis across the country
for that day,
yeah.
Right?
Whereas a lot of the skywarn and local work is on local communications and
correct,
really
yep.
Keeping it pretty local.
Yep. What we primarily use out of our office is, and I should say, with the help of volunteers in the local clubs who often will come up and help us communicate and help us work the radios. We work on more of a local band, if you will, or, mm-hmm. or frequencies that are more shorter range so that we can just talk with the communities around our area. So,
I was going to ask Greg or Dan, have either of you worked with Skywarn, been spotters, been out there participating in those kind of network operations?
Oh, yeah.
And?
Yeah.
And what's that like?
I remember once sitting up on the hill over by Nodine and thought my truck was going to tip right over the hill because the wind came up and grabbed me. I learned to be a little safer with where I parked after that.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with being down at the boat landing by Stoddard. That was a time when we had a bunch of straight line winds, I guess, and went down County K. And just getting home from there was difficult because there were so many trees down across the highway. And
is it just that you're, Todd, just relying on these types of reports during what we think of as severe weather now, during the summer, tornadoes, severe thunderstorms, that type of thing? Or do you take reports in during, I don't know, winter severe weather, things like that? I mean, how does that support what you're trying to do, too?
Yeah, we will any time of year. It's not as often, but there'll be times when there might be an icing event or a quick snow burst that hits a community. And sometimes we will get on the radios that we have at our office and try to reach out to the communities mm-hmm. via amateur radio and just see, you know, who's out there and what they're experiencing. So,
and we
that's
live
just
in
another facet of how the communication is so important.
I was saying we live in a flood prone area too. So
yeah, when we expect weather in the area, we try to make an effort to check in and see who's out there, because if people like Greg or Dan and others in the area that are volunteering their time, we certainly want to take their information if we have someone available. So,
beyond anticipating severe weather and what have you, amateur radio clubs can be very handy at the rescue, if you will, after an event, after a tornado or after a severe storm comes through, by providing emergency communications. Is that primarily the role that amateurs would play, Greg?
That's correct. I remember the Stockton flood. Well, it's going back a ways now, but they lost quite a few homes and so forth, and communications was down for quite a while there. And we had our communications trailer over there for about a week and a half, and people were relying on us to get communications out of the Stockton area, whether it be for an emergency or just somebody wanting to get word to a relative that they were fine. So, I mean, that was about a week and a half that they continued to do that.
And I've I've also been up at damage surveys after larger size tornadoes and, you know, overhear traffic on amateur radio side of, you know, like Greg said, all kinds of relay of where emergency equipment needs to go, but a lot of information being passed on to emergency management officials and just coordination because there is no other communication really out there to so that everyone's talking on the same page. So I've seen it work.
And sometimes we assist other organizations such as the Red Cross or the Salvation Army if we're not needed for you know, other sorts of communications. There's organizations like that that like to have us help them out, and, you know, we'll put somebody right at their location, and then we'll have people out in cars, you know, checking on supplies or things that are needed at other locations. And like the tornado that went through St. Peter, Minnesota, a number of years ago, some people from our club went over there with our trailer and spent a few days over there helping out as well.
In this day and age of continuous communications on all fronts, cell phones especially come to mind. Why do we need amateur radio to replace that?
Well, cell phones require a cell tower, and they can go down, whether it's physically go down or by overuse. You take the Boston bombing. Mm-hmm. Too many people were using their cell phones, and it timed out. So there was no communication by your cell phone at that time. Amateur radio operators were called into service right then and there. I mean, the telephones can go down.
And in part, that's because in that instance, there were amateur radio operators there or assisting with the race itself. And that leads us into another part of, I guess, what this is all about. For instance, the Riverland Amateur Radio Club is a ARRL designated special service club. I'm not sure if this is part of why you all do what you do, but you help provide communications for other kind of community events as well, not just emergencies.
Well, yeah, that's true. We are a special service club. Special service is something the ARRL started back, I think it was about 1985, 86, somewhere in there. And what that meant was your club had to be all-encompassing. We would take every phase of amateur radio, and your club needed to touch on each one of those subjects.
So emergency communications might be part of it, field day, involving the public.
And training, okay. Licensing, different things like that. So we got into that partly back then. I worked with the ARRL and became the special service coordinator in the state of Wisconsin. So I worked kind of heavily into it, and I thought, well, you know, Riverland ought to become a special service club too. So we worked with the criteria, and we got them all set up and became a special service club.
So to some of the services, the community services or the public services that you provide, tell us a little bit about those things, because I know that you help communications for parades or bike marathons.
We have the MS Walk. We have amateur radio operators stationed at the start point and at different places throughout the route. What our function is to make sure that anything that happens along the route that needs attention, as an example, we had one lady fall down and couldn't continue her walk. Well, we have a spotter car come around and pick her up and get her back to the safe spot. Or if anybody else falls down or anything and needs attention. Mm-hmm. We do the Minds in Motion bike tour. That being a longer event, requiring a few more ham radio operators stationed all along the route, doing the same thing. And we've had instances where a rider has gone down and needed medical attention. We relay that back. We get somebody out there to help them as soon as possible.
One other event we did this year, too, was the Granddad Half Marathon.
That's correct.
And we had people along the route there. And I actually had runners come up to me. I was wearing, you know, one of the green vests, and I had a radio, so they knew I was a volunteer. And I actually had some people run out of their way to come up to me and shake my hand and thank me for doing that. So a heartwarming thing, too, to know that they appreciated us. And some of them said, well, without you guys, we wouldn't be able to have this event. So,
in this day and age of cell phones and the internet, all of the technical interconnections that everybody has, who is still typically interested in this type of radio communications activity, this radio thing and walkie-talkies or portable car radios and things like that?
Who's interested? I mean,
who's doing it? Yeah,
it's a variation across all age groups and all types of people. You can see that just in our club meetings. The age that we have in there, you know, the teens all the way up to 90 years old. It's a varied group. And, you know,
it's not just guys either, not all the time.
No, it's gals too.
Yeah.
And, you know, You talk about the cell phones. How many times have you picked up a cell phone and just dialed in a number and said, what the heck, I'm going to talk to this person? So you really don't do that. You get on ham radio and talk to people around the world. You just don't do that with a cell phone. Amateur radio, you can make friends all the way around the world.
Well, the best of luck this weekend. Field day, rain or shine?
Yes. If it's lightning, we may have to cease operation for a while.
And again, people are welcome to come out Saturday morning while you're setting up and right on through Saturday evening.
Right.
You said overnight?
Yeah, we'll be there
24 hours a day through midday on Sunday.
Right. We'll have probably 4 or 5 different stations set up with different antennas, from tall vertical antennas to one guy likes to bring his antenna that he makes out of 2 slinkies. And I'm going to have
that's fairly innovative.
A long wire antenna strung up that's mm-hmm. like 107 feet long, and that'll be fun to play with too.
And Greg, tell us again, easiest way to get to your place, north out of Holman on 53, follow the signs.
When you're going past Whispering Pines Campground, it's the first left, A. Johnson Road. It kind of S-curves down in there. You'll see the signs pointing to my driveway and back where the event's taking mm-hmm. place.
Greg Miller is president of the Riverland Amateur Radio Club. We also heard from Dan Apps, who's chairing the club's field day activities this weekend, and Todd Shea, the warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in La Crosse. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Links to the Riverland Amateur Radio Club's website and the American Radio Relay League's National Field Day website are available on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find audio extras with today's guests, commenting on the costs of getting into ham radio and on the ARRL's 100th anniversary year. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. Coming up next, a discussion about what summertime activities mean for kids in the La Crosse area. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. This is Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Whether it be a camp or a baseball league, there are hundreds of summer programs in the Coulee region that cater to kids. And while the programming in the summer may be more physical or geared towards fun activities that children experience differently throughout the school year, that doesn't mean they aren't learning something in the process. Joining us to talk about the importance of summer youth programs for children are Christine Posey, the Director of Girl Leadership for the Girl Scouts of Wisconsin Badgerland Council, and Mike Desmond, the Executive Director of the Boys and Girls Club of Greater La Crosse. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked Mike Desmond what some of the favorite summer programs at the Boys and Girls Club are.
Well, I think in the summer, we focus on 3 areas: academics, and again, that isn't quite as intense during the summer; character and leadership development, which is a lot of mentoring programs, individual mentoring programs, and then healthy lifestyles is obviously the biggest one, where we, again, get kids active. I think the highlight of the summer, though, is really the theme weeks and the field trips that we take. Again, Mount Olympus is this week. There's Lake Wazee, Devil's Lake, Perot State Park, Madison Zoo, all sorts of things like that. I think the best thing, though, is at the end of the summer, to kind of celebrate that healthy lifestyle thing, we have a Club Olympics, and we hold it right out here at UWL at the stadium, and our three major clubs all wear different T-shirts and compete against each other in a variety of games and sports and things like that. And again, it's all fun, but it's designed to teach kids to have an active lifestyle and not just sit behind a computer screen or in front of a TV all day.
Christine, what about the Girl Scouts? Do you provide more programming in the summer, and what are some of the favorites for the girls? I assume the camps are very popular.
We actually offer, just right there in your area at Campy Howie, we have over 52 programs for girls and parents. So a lot higher occurrence of programs during the summer months, and they happen on all days of the week. Some of the most popular ones are programs like Camp Nibbler, where that's one of the ones where girls can come out for just a single overnight. Me and My Gal and My Guy and I are ones for an adult. It doesn't have to be father or mother. It can be a special adult male like grandpa or uncle or grandma or Aunt Susie. Everybody can come out and really experience camp together and get a taste of what it's like to go away to camp, where girls can build that independence. Girls just have a great time coming out to camp. They build their own skills, have the opportunity to be independent, which there's not a lot of that on their own, where it's guided by the adults in a safe environment, and yet girls get to experience things, try things they might not get to try at home, and of course be in the out of doors and experience what that's like and unplug for a little while from the technology. Some of the other ones we have that our girls are really excited about are Camp Confidence, where girls get to test out challenges and challenge themselves in the out of doors. We also have a program called Yummy Art, where girls are creating in the kitchen and creating edible artwork, which will be very exciting. And we also have, one of the things is that Girl Scouts nationally just did a whole entire study on the outdoor experience for girls, and we were definitely not surprised to see that the girls who experience the outdoors as a child have personal growth and empowerment. They try new things, they learn to overcome their fears, and learn about teamwork and leadership skills.
I'm not sure if there are studies that show the impact of summertime programming on kids, but I assume these summer programs do have a big impact on kids and families as well.
All the research from Boys and Girls Club of America tells us this, and that is to the degree that you can develop meaningful relationships with kids, all of the risk factors begin to decrease extensively. And the amount of positive behavior, like Christine was talking about, in terms of building self-confidence and independence and making good decisions and all those kinds of things, increase. Whether it's going to a camp out at Camp Ihaue, or even something as simple as going down to the Dells with a bunch of kids with a staff member, to the degree in which those relationships can be developed, all the research shows that kids just do better the more positive relationships they have in their life. And that's, in essence, what all these programs do.
Christine, if the Girl Scouts of America track this as well?
Yes. They actually just recently did an entire study that, about the benefits of outdoor experiences, specifically for girls, because we are a girl-serving organization. So they targeted and looked at girls, and not just Girl Scouts, but girls all over the U.S., and what they found was that through an outdoor experience like girls get in Girl Scouts, nearly three-quarters, about 72% of girls improved the skill, 48% helped other girls do an outdoor activity, and they found that they actually enjoy it a lot. That's one thing. I know there can be a perception that girls don't like being in the out of doors, and it's clear that they really enjoy it. There's two-thirds, 62% of them, enjoyed their outdoor experiences they participate in, and camping was one of the most memorable outdoor activities for girls. It's a great opportunity for girls to have fun with other people, building friendships and strengthening friendships, and also interacting with the natural world.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis, and we are talking about the importance of summer youth programs with our guest, Boys and Girls Club of the Greater La Crosse Area, Executive Director Mike Desmond, and Christine Posey, who is Director of Girl Leadership for the Girl Scouts of Wisconsin Badgerlin Council. The poverty rate is quite high for families in the upper Midwest, but in general terms, I think the poverty rate is higher than most people would like to see it be. Are summer programs important just to make sure that kids are being fed, Mike?
You know, again, in the summer, we open at 7 a.m. A special program for the families that are a lot of single-parent families. They have to get to work. They don't have a lot of options for their children. They don't want to leave their kids home alone. And in that case, we feed them breakfast. We feed them lunch. And then, of course, they get an afternoon snack before their parents pick them up. So that's probably been the biggest area of improvement for us and a concern for us is the number of kids that were going home hungry and tell us that their afternoon snack that they get at the Boys and Girls Club is dinner for them. So we, with the help of some great businesses in La Crosse, we've been able to beef that up and provide kids a healthier meal. We're working with the school district on that. We work with Quick Trip on that. But a growing concern. In some of the neighborhoods we serve, it's 70% of the kids are on free and reduced lunch.
Are you doing that year-round as well? I know.
Yes, we
after are. School programming is very important.
Right. What we did is we still give them an afternoon snack, and then we stay open at night for the teens, which is middle school on up, and we provide them a meal. We actually cook a meal, and it's kind of neat because you get the kids helping prepare the meal and so forth. But that's obviously a growing concern in our community is kids being fed.
What are the funding challenges for the Girl Scouts and the Boys and Girls Clubs? And what kinds of challenges do those pose in the summertime, Christine?
I'd say funding for our girls is, of course, we definitely need all the support that we can get because we are, of course, an organization that's serving our youth. One of the things that we look to do to try it is we also try to help people to understand we provide camperships to girls. So if they are a member of our organization, they can apply for a campership to receive partial or up to full support in order to go to camp during the summer months and receive that as an opportunity. We also have the opportunity, and I believe this is unique to Girl Scouts, but our cookie sales go to a lot more than just what people take home and eat the cookies. That is what a girl can use funds that she earns through the cookie sale to support her program, whether that's going to camp or another program throughout the year, or we have even girls who go across the country, that they use those funds they earn through selling cookies to be able to support their own experience. So even if their family can't afford for them to go to camp during the summer months, they can still help support it, and then that combining that with a campership, they're usually able to go without necessarily their family having to take any money out of their own pockets for groceries or whatever else that they may need as a family.
Mike,
our funding challenges are I think, in some ways unique because Boys and Girls Clubs are, by philosophy, located in the areas of most need in a community, the areas of highest poverty. So it's our philosophy not to try to balance our budget on the backs of kids or families in that neighborhood. So we charge $20 for a yearly membership. We have 40% of the kids that can't pay that even. We get a portion of that or whatever. It costs us maybe $400 per kid per year, so you can see the gap. And that's all pretty much privately supported by the generosity of people in this community, simple as that, individuals, businesses, the United Way. If there wasn't no United Way, if there wasn't the generosity that we experience here in La Crosse, there would be no Boys and Girls Club. We're not a government-sponsored agency. So we get our mission out there. We tell them what we're trying to do, and we've just been very, very fortunate that the people of La Crosse have supported the Boys and Girls Club for so many years.
And you've been able to expand quite a bit in recent years as well to other communities and offering different types of programs. And does that speak to community support? It couldn't be done without it, could it?
It cannot be done without it. And, we have six sites now in the La Crosse area, two outside of the actual city of La Crosse, one in a big club in West Salem and a smaller club in La Crescent. And I think that's going to be the trend as, again, people in the outlying areas, those kids face the same risk factors as kids do in the city of La Crosse. And we're wearing blinders if we think that that doesn't exist. Those kind of challenges don't exist in the outlying areas as well. So we will probably continue to expand. I know we're going to expand our teen services and our teen room here in La Crosse itself. But again, I look at it this way. When I see 50, 100 teens walking in our building, I think that's a good thing. They've made a good choice.
Christine, how have the numbers been for the Girl Scouts? Are they holding steady? Or are you increasing the numbers of girls or seeing a decline?
overall, this year we have seen a small decline. However, we are looking at what we are doing in order to increase people's awareness, like in this situation, of what we do, the importance of what girls can get through Girl Scouting, whether it's through Girl Scout camp or also through, again, we've talked about cookies and how girls can support their own experience. We, too, have a $25 membership fee per year, and we also provide support for that if girls can't afford that. But again, we also provide plenty of opportunities for girls to have experiences that they can support and that their families can support without money out of their own pockets. We also want to help people to understand and see the value of Girl Scouting. You know, we are a 102-year-old organization, and we're very proud of that. And we are started because our founder wanted to teach young women independent skills. She looked around, and this was before women could even vote, and said, girls need to know how to balance a checkbook. They need to know how to handle their money. And we still to this day follow that mission of trying to provide girls experiences and opportunity to help them grow and develop as young women. So when they become adults, they can be women, whether they're independent or married or decide to travel the world, wherever they go, whatever they do, they will have skills to support their experiences well into adulthood.
Christine, what would girls do without the Girl Scout program?
Gosh, that makes me kind of sad to think about. Girls today, I say that as Girl Scouts, we have been part of developing the world that we are in today. As I just said, we were founded in 1912. And we've been here all this time. And all this time, from the start with Juliet Gordon Lowe to now, girls have, through Girl Scouting, learned what they can achieve and what they can do. And because of that, and because of girls' eyes opening, they now know they can be a scientist, they can be an astronaut, they can be president, they can be whatever they choose. And they know that because throughout the length of our organization, girls have learned that they can stand up and be independent and to look out at the world and know what they can achieve and to be courageous and strong. So that is definitely what we know that girls will do. If Girl Scouting didn't exist and if Girl Scouts weren't here, I don't know, to be honest, what part, where that would fill in. I know that girls would know that these opportunities exist, but the world that we have developed to this day is, I believe, partly because of all the many women who have come through Girl Scouting and become leaders in our world.
Now, both of you have talked a little bit about this, but I know there's an emphasis on fun in the summer with a lot of these programs, but there is a lot of learning that goes on as well. Is there not, Christine?
Oh, absolutely. Our programming always has a learning component to it. Like you said, the fun covers everything, and even as the girls are learning, they are having an absolutely great time because we do programs in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. We do wellness programs. We offer programs where girls will build their skills as well as learn more about themselves, and so we want the girls to learn and to know what they can do for Wisconsin. We also have, as an experience, we have outcomes that we incorporate into everything that we do. We have 15 outcomes that we work into all of our programming. And so that girls, we know that they're getting these outcomes as part of what they do, with the ultimate long-term outcome of building girls of courage, confidence, and character.
Is there anything either of you two would like to add to the discussion?
Well, I'd like to talk about our Camp Send a Kid. How many years has that been going on, Christine? Do you know?
Oh, goodness, I don't. Over
Before
a decade, I believe,
yeah.
If not more.
Anyhow, through the graciousness of the Girl Scouts who host this at Camp Ehowie, we have formed our own 501(c), which is really a collaboration between the Girl Scouts, the Boy Scouts, the Boys and Girls Club, the YMCA, and a couple other youth-serving organizations. And we offer a camp experience for those, at-risk kids, kids that may be living in poverty, kids that might not normally have a camp experience, and so on and so forth. So it's been, again, a great collaboration between a lot of organizations that serve youth. The La Crosse Tribune has spearheaded this program for years, has helped raise money for this program for years. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Christine, I think there's about 75 kids every summer that go to the camp. And you could speak more to the actual camp itself.
It's about 75. There is an application process that the campers go through to be selected. And we do have kids who return after a couple of years, year after year. It runs the gamut, the programming, each year, and sometimes it varies from year to year, where kids get to go swimming in our pool. They go creek hopping down at Crystal Creek. They also get to do the traditional camp activities like arts and crafts. But they also have some really neat things. I know in the past we've had the Life Flight land right there at Campy Howie, and kids get to actually see that right in person.
Christine Posey is the director of Girl Leadership for the Girl Scouts of Wisconsin Badgerland Council, and Mike Desmond is the executive director of the Boys and Girls Club of Greater La Crosse. They spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about the benefits of summer youth programs. People have until tomorrow to register for Camp Send a Kid, which will be held August 17th through the 21st at Camp Ehowie near Mindoro. There is no cost for children who go to Camp Send a Kid. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find a link to the Girl Scouts and the Boys and Girls Club. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, photos, and links to our archives, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.